Today is May 3rd, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the Original Personal Computer Radio Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. Our website is pcradioshow.org. The Personal Computer Show on WBAI-FM tonight has been preempted for a membership drive. We will not be on the air tonight at 9 p.m. Some things occur on a very rare occasion that we don't think about it ever happening to us. I've had, however, two instances going back to 1956 where lightning struck and it damaged electronic hardware. Lightning passing through a house will often branch and utilize more than one path to ground at a time. It can also jump through the air from one conductive path to another in what is called a side flash. For example, lightning may first connect to electrical lines in the attic of a house and then jump to better grounded water pipes on the first or second floor. Lightning can connect to gutters, then jump to a window frame as a stepping stone to the electrical system or water pipes. All or part of boats have been seen jumping from wall outlets to sink, faucets, and even across rooms. The first time it happened to me was when lightning struck my DeckWriter LA-36. It fried the data cable to crisp. Fortunately, replacement of the cable was not expensive, but it did cause quite a concern on my part. The second time it happened, it bricked my U.S. Robotics Courier 2400 external modem. Now I have an assortment of voltage regulators, UPS units, and surge strips attached to the equipment. In over 60 years, I've been affected by lightning twice. I didn't think a heavy-duty printer requires any electrical protection. When it did happen, what were the odds of happening again? Did you know that lightning is the single biggest cause of damage to and destruction of electrical and electronic equipment in industrial facilities, commercial buildings, and homes? Due to the ever-changing climate and rising temperature, lightning strikes are becoming more and more frequent. I asked Marty Winston to make his comment on how surge affects electronic equipment.
There's something that came up as we were looking at surge protection in our big project, 40-year house. 40yearhouse.com has more about that. Involving my new phone, which is a Galaxy S8. And Galaxy S8 comes with a very nice QC2 fast charger that uses both 5 volts and 9 volts to help charge the phone more rapidly than usual. I believe the store told me that if I wanted to buy a spare charger for the phone, it was $50. Wow. Comes with the phone, happily, so that is not a requirement. And of course, you can always just plug in any USB, although it's USB-C, which is also more expensive, plug into any USB port, that cable comes with it, I should add, and it will charge at the old slower rates. So that is that thing. And then it occurred to me, and I double-checked this, that charger and that phone can both fry if there's a lightning strike nearby. The answer, the solution, the protection is pretty easy. Put surge protection on the outlet you plug your charger into. But how many of you think in terms of connected gear frying because lightning passes through the charger. These chargers do not have built-in surge protection. They don't have the MOVs or anything else to stop a surge from coming through the power line and into that $400, $500, $600, $700, $800 phone you just bought. And is it protected against that? Take a look. I know what I would guess. Take a good look. So chargers for your smartphones, for your tablets, for your notebooks, that EMP on the power line from a lightning strike, they're vulnerable. They're very vulnerable. So it's a really good idea to plug every charger into a surge protected outlet. Now, what about other batteries that get charged? Do you have tool batteries? Some of the tool batteries cost as much or more than the tools they power. Each tool brand tends to have a battery system where you're plugging the same battery into a lot of different gear, and then the battery has a charger that it plugs into. Is that charger surge protected? And that answer will vary from vendor to vendor, but again, you know, surge protector in the wall makes so much sense. Or as we're doing the 40-year house, surge protect the whole house if you can. I just had occasion to have long chats with installers for both landline phones, wired phones, and for cable TV internet service. The landline guy also had some experience with fiber, the U-verse in his case. This was AT&T landlines for what that's worth. And I asked each of them separately, do you have any surge protection for the wire as it enters the house? And the phone guy said, yeah, sure, look at this. And there was a ground rod right underneath. He said, There's some kind of lightning trap in it. I said, is it a gas discharge tube? He said, it might be. I don't know. That's fair. There's lightning protection there. Is it enough? Well, is it ever enough? I'm doing something else I'll get at in a minute. I asked the cable TV guy. I said, no, there really isn't. There's no lightning protection outside the wall. You're going to have to do it inside, and you're going to want to do it before it gets to their indoor equipment, which is down from 3 boxes to 1, I'm happy to say, but that could vary for you guys. So what do you do? Well, yeah, you plug the boxes and their power adapters, or in some cases their chargers, into a surge-protected outlet, maybe even surge-protected through a UPS, so there's battery backup there. And that's where I wanted to point you, because UPSs, at least beyond the bare minimum ones, most UPSs also offer connections for surge protecting coax or Ethernet plugs. Loop it through. It takes you one extra length of cable to do that, and surges will be stopped on the Ethernet connections. Surges will be stopped on the coax connection coming into your cable system. You've stopped surges there, if not at the wall. You've stopped surges on your chargers. What else do you have to do? Let's not worry about that this week. But remember, if surge protection isn't happening outside the wall, unless you're plugged into protection, it isn't happening. And that's not exactly backup, but it still takes us back to Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Now I need another piece of equipment. By the way, Marty, food for thought. Is lightning AC or DC electricity?
Hank, yeah. You and Marty worry about whether lightning is AC or DC. I worry about something else. Is the surge protector I'm still using, is it any good? Fine, I plugged my telephone charger into it, but how do I know it's working?
Well, it's very easy.
How do I know?
Very easy, because on the surge protectors, there's two types. One uses a little switch that actually will cause it to turn off, and then you can reset it so you don't have to buy a new surge protector. But then you have these cheap surge protectors that give you a little glowing light. If the light is on constantly, it's good, and if it's blinking, it's gone.
Well, yes and no, Hank. I have an expensive surge protector, and it's got a switch so that I can use it as a power strip to turn everything on or off. And it's also got a little yellow light that glows, and it's also flickering. So the fact that it's more expensive doesn't help me. The Verista, which is the thing that the Lightning does whatever it does to, it's a one-time thing. It gets hit once, and it's out. It's gone. And you got to look at that flickering light. If it's flickering, you have a power strip, but you have no protection.
Yeah, you know, I find that when you're talking about high-end surge protectors, you get into the $20, $30 range, and you find that the low-end UPS systems that Marty refers to is as cheap as $30 and, you know, and up, okay? And you get a lot more functionality, and they're resettable. So I would recommend that, you know, if you have a lot of equipment, put it onto a higher unit. By the way, don't put everything onto one unit. In other words, spread it around. Because if everything is on one unit, you can, you know, take out a whole lot of stuff. By the way, I was shocked. The Galaxy S8 charger is $50. Wow.
Well, how much is the charger for...
For my phones? $6.
There you go.
By the way, it's not losing the $50 you worry about. It's the phone on the other end of it that you can lose in total.
Have you ever lost a phone from a nearby lightning hit?
I think I did, but I have to verify it because I have a Motorola phone that I took apart and I got to check it out. But I think that it didn't get fried, but I think it got knocked out. And right now I don't find it to be practical to either fix it now. I just got a new unit. Okay, it's just not practical now. I'm not like you having a Pixel, okay? Because that Pixel costs you a pretty penny, and in my case, you know what? I have the cheap stuff.
Well, I'll tell you, the Pixel has a lot of new features in it, and I'm not going to do a review of it tonight, but it's got one feature in it that had me flummoxed for about 2 hours until I realized it.
Oh, whether the cable goes in one way or the other way?
No, the cable goes in either way you want it to if you have the right cable.
Right. In other words, downside up or upside down?
I have so much legacy stuff, Hank. I have cables that go this way and that way and the other way. I was out with my Pixel the other day. Well, actually, it was the other month. And I realized I had forgotten to charge it overnight, and it was just about at zero. So I opened up my little bag that I carry with me, and I pulled out a plug, and I pulled out a cable, and I plugged the plug in the wall, and I plugged the cable into the plug, and then went to plug the other end of the cable into the phone, and guess what? It didn't fit. The Pixel did not have a micro USB slot in the back. It had something else. And my phone went dead. When I got home that night, I looked at the cable that came with it, and it had a different cable. It had a complete, no key. It had a completely oval cable, or oval plug.
Elliptical, right?
Elliptical, and right. It could go either way, upside down, inside out, or backwards. And it was a speed charger, no matter which way I used it. But I needed a separate new cable. The 15 or 20 cables and 15 or 20 chargers I had weren't good enough. I now needed another one for the Pixel, and I'm sure someplace it told me that, but you know, most of us don't read every detail on the fine print. We were too anxious to get started using the product. Well, now I have, Hank, a situation where I have a couple of dozen cables that are totally useless.
Useless, but you can get adapter cables. Hey, Joe, you know, one of the most confusing part about all these connecting ports is that you have USB 2.0, USB 3.1, you have USB-C, and then you have the original USB 1.1, and you have micro USB, you have mini USB, you have USB. I mean, like...
Yeah, you know how that affects us? I'm looking right now...
It's confusing.
I'm looking right now at a Newegg page. As you said, there are adapters I could buy, so while you said that, I was clicking away on my computer, and I came to this. USB 3.1 Type-C adapter, CPAS, high-speed micro USB 3.1 Type-C male to standard Type-A USB 3 female. What?
I would call them up and say, I got this unit. What should I get? That's what I would do. No, seriously, it's very confusing because you have legacy hardware, you have new hardware, you have competing hardware, and it, right now it's very confusing. It really is. But let me tell you something, though. If you happen to be going on a trip, make sure you test out all the different cables you need, because you don't want to say, oh, I'm going to make the assumption that if I need it, I'll buy it. It's not that easy.
Well, the question becomes, why? What does this this Type C give me that Type D Micro didn't give me?
Well, let me put it this way. The C gives you DisplayPort capability and higher speed capability. However, the 3.1 has a different functionality, and it depends on what the peripheral unit is. So it's very confusing, and the worst part is not the peripheral itself, but the port itself, because the way the port is defined limits to what you can actually hook up to it. Like I know in some cases, like I happen to have a optical reader, in other words, a USB optical reader, and I find that on some units, I go to two USB ports and it powers a unit. And on others, I need a separate AC adapter to go into the wall to power the unit. So it varies all over the place.
It is. You know something? Somebody once asked me, maybe it was you, about 35, 40 years ago, what made me get into computers? And I said it was pretty simple. I really admire trees, and I really admire the complexity of the leaves with a stoma and whatnot. But I'm damned if I understand how it works. Only God can make a tree. But computers are just as confusing, and I can really study it and learn how it works. You know something? I'm back at the stage where, to me, it could be a leaf. I don't understand any of this anymore.
Joe, it's very easy. You know what rule number one is to understand computers? RTFM. Read the fine manual.
I'll give you a very secret answer to that, Hank.
Yeah.
Would you like to hand me the manual on any equipment that I've bought over the last year and a half? There are no manuals. There's a thing, a four-page leaflet called "Read This First."
Well,
and it doesn't tell you anything.
I'll tell you something that would probably driven you mad already, if not already mad. Okay, is that I could tell you that you're going to buy something brand new, and when you buy it, you don't know what the speed is. You know what I'm driving at?
Absolutely, because I came across it last week. In specific, you were talking with the people from Acronis, and while you were talking, I figured I would do a little test backup and see what was going on. So I slipped. I have a wonderful thing I bought for next to no money, a terabyte USB drive.
You bought a flash drive.
It's a flash drive, and it's about the size of my thumbnail, and it cost me $20 or $25. I don't remember what. Not next to nothing for a terabyte. It was great. So I plugged it in, and I started running the Acronis backup. You got off the air. I had dinner. I came back in and looked. It was still running. The next morning, I checked 4.5 hours before it finished. 4.5 hours. It was an 86 gigabyte backup that Acronis did. 4.5 hours. I said, well, my heavens, suppose I had backed up one of my BIC drives. It would have taken a week. I called you up, and what did you say to me?
Listen, when you back up onto a USB flash drive or you read or write on it, no matter what the cost is, what the brand name is, what the capacity is, even the same model number, you have no idea what the read speed is and what the write speed is.
So therefore, I said, am I just shooting crap? Is there no... I mean, that was an unsatisfactory answer. So for that, you gave me an answer. You said, well, run this program. You gave me the name of the program. I forget what it was, Hank.
Well, I'll tell you what it was. Speed out.
Zero, and it was
0.5. 0.5 is free.
0.5 means means it's not out of beta yet, but it's free and you can do it. But there's this hook to it. There's a trick to it. There's a catch me, a give me, whatever you want to call it. You need to buy the drive first. You can't just do it from the model number or the picture of it. You have to have the drive.
Well, and also, you got to break the seal, open the package to test it, and once you open the package, you used it.
Well, on mine, it was even worse than that, Hank. It came to me from China, and without a full return address, I don't know where I could have returned it. I would have given it to you and said, on your next trip over there, bring this back.
Well, one of the things I do, Joe,
why can't there be a standard? When I buy a hard drive, Western Digital tells me everything I need to know about it.
And it's pretty exact, too. In other words, when you buy memory to upgrade your computer, the speed is very exact. It's very accurate. When you talk about a hard disk drive or solid-state drive, the speed is known. They tell you what it is. But when you buy a USB flash drive and or a card flash drive too, I mean,
an SD card or something like that.
It varies all over the lot what the speed is.
I put a micro SD card into my cell phone. It was a 64 gig card, and it was. No, it was not a brand X card. It was a brand name card. And I noticed that my phone, in areas where it needed the SD card, was really much, much slower than it had been before I inserted it. Just to make sure I was right, I had a 4-gig card that came with the phone. And I went and did the exact same thing, but I used this card. And it was about a 3 or 4 times slower with the SD card, which, you know, every time I hear somebody say to me, we have too many government regulations, let the companies regulate themselves, I think of my USB cards and my SD cards. And grief.
Listen, I can go one better than that. In other words, you want complete freedom in standards. Look at Linux. There's so many different versions of it that there is no standard.
But at least most of the people involved in Linux have a modicum of ethics. Most of the manufacturers that I deal with, you know, and less than the type A or grade A, top level, first tier of manufacturers, most of the ones below that want to make money at any cost, and if the cost is my misery, that's fine with them. They have no problems. It's all my fault because I was trying to save money, and I shouldn't try and do that. I'm sorry. Standards serve a purpose. People who don't like standards or companies that don't like standards are basically dishonest. They want a way to rip me off, and I don't care about anything that they say about freedom. Freedom of choice is not your freedom to hurt me. Freedom of choice is my freedom to pick who I want.
Hey, but Joe, you had presented a problem to me, and we talked about it, and I just want to cover it, and that's, can you imagine going to a wedding or to a graduation, and you take lots of pictures, be it videos or stills, and people come up to you and say, can you send me what you just taken? And you've taken, especially with digital pictures, you've taken a couple hundred shots. And can you imagine?
I don't have to imagine it, Hank. I went to my niece's wedding, and her future husband, her husband, came from the West Coast. She was here, of course, in Pennsylvania. And I met a lot of people I had never known, his relatives, his friends who came in for the wedding. And I had a digital camera with me, and it was it was taking some pretty decent pictures. I was shooting like crazy, and I even actually, I don't know how many I shot, but at one point I changed the SD card, and that's why I must have shot a whole bunch of them. And almost everybody was saying to me, please, here's my email address, send it to me when you're all finished. And well, I had a way of doing it that was much easier than that. I, I went to a thing which no longer exists, but there are comparables. I went to a thing called the Kodak Gallery, and I uploaded every picture from every card that I had. The Kodak Gallery gave me a URL, and I sent it out to their emails, and I said, here, go to this URL.
But Joe, you still had to upload one file at a time.
No, I didn't, Hank. I uploaded subdirectories.
Okay, it's still subdirectories.
You can do that.
Hey, you know, there's an easier way. I hope you know that.
I do not know that, and I would probably never do this again. It was a real pain in the neck.
Well, you know, I've been asked that question on how do you do it efficiently and quickly. And it's very simple. It's create an image file of all the pictures as one file. Or
You mean the way I create a system image file the same way?
Yeah, well, it's similar. I use a program called IMG Burn, Image Burn, and that can take subdirectories, it can take single files, multi-files, different format files, and just put it as one image file, and you could then upload it to something like Dropbox if it's a big one. If it's small enough, you can transmit it via email to whoever you want to send it to, and it works very well. And when they get the file, and if they're running Windows 10, all they have to do is say mount, M-O-U-N-T, the file, and guess what? In Windows 10, it treats an ISO file, if it has not been associated with another program, as a CD or DVD, and it's a virtual optical drive.
So you're saying I can make a subdirectory into what essence is a virtual CD, mm-hmm. then upload that CD, and you can download pieces of it?
Yes, the whole thing, or one file, or just a subdirectory only, or pieces of it. You could do that, no problem at all.
That's amazing. What's the name of this program?
Well, first of all, there's two parts to it. One is creating the ISO file. There's a lot of programs that can do it. I use IMG Burn, Image Burn, because it's a multifunction program. Instead of having a lot of loose programs, this is an open source program.
What about the Acronis you were talking about last week? Can that do it?
Well, Acronis is backup, okay? And when you backup...
But it makes an image file.
And you don't send your backup image file to someone else, right? That's your backup.
Well, if I only back up the image file of the images, that's what I'm talking about doing.
Yeah, but it's big, okay? Because when you do a image backup of an operating system, it's huge, and you have personal data on it, too. So you don't want to do that.
Acronis can't be selective the way this IMG Burn does.
Yeah. In other words, the IMG Burn is extremely selective on what you want to do. Now, for those who are not running Windows 10, in Windows 7, there's a program you could use. It's called WinISO, W-I-N-I-S-O. And once you install that, you can then open the ISO file, and it will create a virtual optical drive and have all the files for you. And
Hank, I want to say something to the audience, because in the past you have mentioned, as you did tonight, a couple of programs to download, and they've asked me, well, where do you get them from? I can give you the URL to get them, but if you just Google or do a search with the Google engine of that file name that Hank gave you, you will come down with different sources. The only reason I like to ask Hank where should I get it is because I know he's going to give me a clean URL that isn't going to load a bunch of crapware with it.
Well, I find that many of these download areas now, including from the original authors, that you have to be careful how you install, because people tend to click through the file very quickly, not realizing that they are downloading bloatware at the same time. And I hate to say it, but some of the major publishers do that to you too, like Adobe is a good example.
Adobe does it, yes, and I had a problem with CNET and some others over the years. I always try to go to places like FileHippo is a very clean place to go to. There are several others.
So when you download, what I normally do is, now, I don't know if other people have the same luxury, but, you know, I have a very cheap unit I use. When I say cheap, I'm talking about a brand new PC that cost me $100 that I got on Black Friday, and I use that to download. So if I accidentally or unwittingly download some malware, no big deal. Just reset it, and you know, no problem at all. But I, you know, you got to be very careful what you download these days. And and if you haven't heard of it, don't. And if you want to try it, there's two ways of doing it: use a separate system, or use a sandbox. By a sandbox, I mean a virtual operating system as under the operating system, so that it only affects that piece of it and not the whole system. The phishing and malware is so prevalent now, and one of the last things you want to get into is be caught with ransomware, where you're really.
I was just gonna mention, instead of phishing, the thing that a lot of people should be afraid of and they don't realize it is this form of malware called ransomware.
Yeah.
I understand that you've got some protections from it with Acronis, but that's only with one or two of the types of ransomware there are. Nobody can keep up with it. As soon as you have a program or find a way to destroy the ransomware, avoid it, the ransomware people come up with a way to get around that. The world is a different world today.
Well,
it is. Not just computers, but in everything.
Well, it's like I had said that you know, the technology has changed, and you know, some people. Hey, I've got to tell you something that we have a couple of feature segments coming up right after this, and one of the things that we talked about, Big Blue, IBM, back you know, in the early days of the PC. Everyone waited on IBM, and IBM was smug with their big mainframe. And, you know, hey, that old saying, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Well, they basically kept the same business model, and the world passed them by. And you know what? Who I think is they better wake up, because the world can pass them by, is Microsoft and Apple. I remember I told you about what Google was doing, and you said, what? Are you sure? And you were surprised by it.
And tell the folks.
Well, actually, in the feature segments that we have, Alfred is going to talk about Google, the Google Watch. And when I listened to it at first, I said, a Google Watch? When did that come about? And he started describing it, and I think you'll find that of great interest. The other thing is that it's been in the news yesterday, Tuesday. Many of the mainstream media has been reporting on it, is that Google has made tremendous inroads in the education sector. And Joe, what do you think I meant by the education sector? And why the education sector?
On K through 12, Apple has owned that market since personal computers existed.
In past tense, you use the word own. Past tense. Go ahead,
they
John.
Have owned it, but suddenly from no place, Google with the Chromebook that nobody's interested in and nobody likes, suddenly that's taken over the whole market.
No, wait a minute. You say no one likes and no one knows about it. Well, then how could it all of a sudden take over the education market?
Fake news.
No, it's not fake news, okay? But, you know what's been happening? Microsoft and Apple are saying, hey, we have Windows, we have OS X. These are iOS and so on. These are great operating systems. We are, you know, we got the best operating system. And what has Google done? You know what? They came up with the Chrome. They came up with the Chromebook, and it's what the customer is looking for. You think the kids, the younger people in the school system, really care what the operating system is?
Absolutely not.
What they care about is what can they do with it? What can they run on it? And then the other thing, of course, is they don't have the patience we had, is that when a system goes down or boots up, I mean, like I mean, we're so used to getting up early in the morning, turn on the computer, and go for a cup of coffee, and then when the coffee's ready, the machine is ready. Hey, these kids, when they turn the machine on, they expect to be on within a second, right?
Oh, instant. Yeah, absolutely instant.
And of course,
instant gratification.
And then from an educator's point of view, what they're saying is, hey, we got all these kids with all these machines. We can't afford the maintenance every time someone screws up a machine or we got to reload the machine. And Google addressed that and made a big difference.
Well, what do you see? What they did was with Google, when you shut off the machine, fine. When you turn it on again, it goes up to the cloud and reloads the operating system. There's no such thing as right now as a piece of malware that'll survive the previous unit.
There's only one catch to the what Google is depending on for their architecture. And you know what that is,
and?
Joe? You must have a working cloud. Without the cloud...
You mean you've got to be connected to the Internet.
Right. And if you're not connected, it's kind of sort of like you have a lamp and the electricity is not working.
It's also very complicated to print.
I'm surprised they haven't addressed that yet.
They will soon.
They will.
As soon as they hear this program, Hank.
Well, they were also the ones that played around with, came up and got everyone excited about the autonomous car, the driverless car. Hey, Joe, tell you what, we're going to get to those segments now, and I think that the people will find this of quite interest. Just want to let everyone know that next week we will be on again on PRN, but we are again preempted on WBAI. So.
And how do you listen to PRN, Hank?
You go to www.prn.fm on the Internet, and it's 6 p.m., and it's Eastern Daylight Time that you can get us next week. Okay, let's get to those feature segments.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. My first story this week is about a smartwatch. Maybe you're yawning already. Smartwatches continue to be a solution in search of a problem. Early adopters have flocked to them, but they just don't seem to be getting a whole lot of traction in the general marketplace. One of the solutions that some companies are going with are putting minimal smart features into a standard watch. Others are going whole hog into very smart watches that have all kinds of digital functions. But I'm not going to talk about any of those today. I want to talk about a new watch. This is a watch that is designed to measure biometric and environmental data. This watch is able to serve as an electrocardiogram. It measures heart rate, can measure skin electrical activity, and of course it measures physical activity of the person who's wearing it. Unlike many other watches, it can run for up to a week without having to be recharged, and it stores enough data that you don't have to sync it for at least a week. It's very convenient. You don't have to think about it a lot. Stunningly enough, the watch face tells the time all the time. It uses a very low-power, high-resolution display to show the date and time on the face of the watch. This sounds like a potentially interesting watch that some people might like to have, and so I'll ask you, what would you think a watch like this would cost? What do you think? Doesn't matter what you think, because it's not for sale and you can't buy it. I know. What's the point of making a watch that you can't buy? Well, actually, this is a new watch called the Study Watch, and it's made by a company called Verily. And don't feel bad if you've never heard of Verily. It's one part of the larger company called Alphabet, which you may have heard of. Alphabet is the parent company for Google. And Verily is one of the operations that's involved in research. This new study watch is designed for a very precise purpose. According to the company, it's designed for, and I quote, the scalable collection of rich and complex data sets across clinical and observational studies, unquote. In other words, this is a watch that is designed for health and medical research projects. One of the things that other wearable technologies and connected devices could take a lesson from, this device was designed from the ground up to keep the data secure. The data is encrypted within the device itself, even before it's sent to the cloud for storage and processing. As I say, the study watch is not going to be offered to consumers, but instead it's going to go to research partners such as Verily's Personalized Parkinson's Project. It's also going to be used as part of Verily's very ambitious Project Baseline. This is an interesting project that aims to collect rich longitudinal data about 10,000 participants. It's going to take over 4 years to collect all this information. The goal is that by analyzing all kinds of biometric and other kinds of data collected in great detail over these 10,000 volunteers, they hope that they're going to be able to find early markers for cardiovascular disease and cancer so that these illnesses can be identified sooner and treated sooner and hopefully come up with better outcomes at a lower cost. This watch that nobody can buy could end up helping us all become healthier. My second item this week is another wristband, but again, it's not a fitness band, and it's certainly not a traditional smartwatch. One of the things you can tell right away is that it doesn't have any display, so it's very much unlike most watches or fitness bands. The other thing about it is that it has this strange metal cylinder sticking out of it. The cylinder looks a whole lot like one of those aerators that you put on the faucet of your kitchen sink. Turns out that what that device is an ultrasonic transceiver. It broadcasts and receives sound waves that are higher than people can hear. So why would you have that on a wristband? Well, in fact, this band is designed to help people with limited vision navigate just like a bat. It sends out signals that we can't hear, bounces off objects and obstacles in their environment, and gives them feedback by vibrating to let them know if there's an obstacle nearby. It operates in two different ranges. For navigating indoors, it has a range of about 6 feet, which gives you a higher sensitivity. But when you're outdoors, you want more warning about obstacles as they approach. And so it operates at a distance of up to about 12 feet. It does more than just help you navigate, however. It can also discreetly tell you the time by vibrating. You can even get wireless tags that you can put on devices to help you locate items like your briefcase when you've set them down and can't find them. This band is called the Sunu band, S-U-N-U band, and it's already in production. Demand is so great, though, that it's taking about 4 to 6 weeks to fill an order. So this could be a great help to people with limited vision, and it shows an excellent example of how wearable technology can provide an adaptive solution to help individuals with a specific impairment. If you drive a car or truck, chances are you've been there. You're tired, been driving for a long time, you're getting sleepy, you're having trouble staying focused and paying attention, and the fact is, you're putting yourself and others at great risk. According to the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, drowsy driving was responsible for 72,000 crashes and 44,000 injuries and 800 deaths, according to a study in 2013. There's a product out that's aimed to help with this, and what it is a earpiece-style phone headset. You use this along with your cell phone, but in addition to having the microphone and speaker that you'd normally expect in a cell phone earpiece, it also has a bunch of sensors. It's got a 6-axis accelerometer, so it can track your head motion, and it also has infrared sensors that track your eyes and your eyelids. If you are blinking or if your eyes are closing, it can detect that. If your head is nodding, it can detect that motion. What you do is you pair this device, it's called the Vigo, V-I-G-O, from Vigo Technologies. You pair it with your smartphone. If it detects that you're getting sleepy, it can flash a warning, it can vibrate to give you an alert, it can give you an audio alert, or it can even play some pre-selected music to help wake you up. You can also make it so that it can automatically call a family member or a friend to help you wake up and give you somebody to talk to. It's also applicable for fleet applications for companies. It can give supervisors and managers a warning that a driver is getting tired and needs to take a break. The device is rated for up to 10 days of standby on a single charge. It's available now and costs less than $100 from the company's website. We may be coming up on a time in the future when our automated cars will be able to drive for us and we won't have to worry about falling asleep. But for now, drowsy driving is a real problem, and a product like Vigo is something that you can use with your standard smartphone just as you would any other headset, but it can help keep you and other people on the road safer. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Horseless carriage is a term for early automobiles. At the time, it was common that carriages were pulled by horses. Horseless carriages are noted for their similarity to horse-drawn carriages, but instead of with some type of motor. The automobile in the past 100 years have been incrementally changed, but the basic concept remained the same. Now the autonomous driverless vehicle has caught many old guard car manufacturers sleeping at the wheel, resting on past laurels. In many ways, the basic architecture of Microsoft Windows and Apple OS X operating systems has remained the same. Many of the revisions, upgrades, and improvements haven't really changed the fundamental architecture of the operating system. However, Google in stealth mode has had great success in U.S. schools, which is now forcing Microsoft and Apple to change how they develop and sell to the education market. The Chromebook has gone from a standing start in 2011 to wild popularity in the market for education technology, which tech companies have traditionally viewed as a critical way in which to win over the next generation of users. In 2016, mobile devices running Alphabet Inc.'s Google Chrome operating system accounted for 58% of the U.S. market for primary and secondary schools, according to FutureSource Consulting. The success of the Chromebook has awakened the sleeping giants. For years after the release of the Chromebook in 2011, Apple and Microsoft stuck to their strategies of offering slightly modified and discounted versions of their products for the educators. But the Chromebook's low price, it starts at $149, and easy management proved irresistible to many schools. Sales of the Chromebook jumped tenfold between 2012 and 2013. While Google manufactures some Chromebooks, the devices aim at the education market are supplied by such partners as Samsung and Acer. The operating system is free for educators and hardware manufacturers, and Google sells schools an education package, including device management and support, for only a $30 fee. Microsoft hardware partners are now selling hybrid tablet laptop devices based on the Surface design, starting at $189. Microsoft boasted that the operating system announced this Tuesday boots up rapidly. The company also introduced a new code builder addition to its Minecraft, which, by the way, has been quite popular in the education system, to help students learn coding skills through the popular game. Apple, for its part, has lowered the price of the iPad to $299 for education customers and made it possible for students to share devices, in addition to simplifying management. Despite Google's U.S. dominance, its position is weaker in classrooms overseas, where many markets have not yet seen an impetus to embrace technology. In 2016, devices running Android and Chrome made up 23% of the mobile market outside the United States, compared with 65% for Microsoft Windows.
Websites with malicious code? I'll show you a cool service that is your Sherpa through the World Wide Web. In addition to installing a reliable antivirus application on your computer, I suggest configuring OpenDNS. OpenDNS is a great free service that identifies many websites with malicious code and helps you avoid them. So, what is DNS? You don't need to know this part to use OpenDNS, but essentially DNS translates domain names for websites into something that computers understand, IP addresses. Whenever you type a website's address into your web browser, your computer has no idea what you're talking about because it doesn't speak English. In a fraction of a second, your computer goes out to the internet to a specified DNS server and figures out the IP address for the website you'd like to visit. It does this translation behind the scenes. You never see it. You're probably doing what most people do, which is using your internet service provider's DNS servers. However, OpenDNS manages translating domain names to IP addresses and then blocks access to dangerous websites it has identified. Configuring OpenDNS on your router or computer is really simple. Here are the steps for configuring your computer. Now, it may sound like a lot of steps, but it's actually pretty easy. I'll describe the steps for Windows, and you can always rewind if I go too fast. Ready? Here we go. First, open Control Panel. Next, open Network Sharing Center. On the left, click Change Adapter Settings. Look through the list and find the device that your computer uses to connect to the internet. If your computer connects using a network cable, look for something like Local Area Connection. If your computer uses Wi-Fi, look for something like Wi-Fi. Okay, double-click the device, and then you're going to click the Properties button. Select Internet Protocol Version 4, but do not uncheck it. There's an Internet Protocol Version 6, but it is very unlikely you're using that protocol. Click the Properties button. Now, I recommend taking a picture or writing down all the settings. Just in case if there's an issue, you can then return to the original settings. Okay, select Use the following DNS server addresses radio button. And for preferred DNS server, we're going to enter the IP address 208.67.222.222. And for alternate DNS server, we're going to enter 208.67.220.220. If you'd like to configure OpenDNS to also block adult websites identified by their service, use instead the IP address 208.67.222.123 for preferred DNS server, and 208.67.220.123 for alternate DNS server. Save your changes and restart your computer. And then the last step, just test your settings by visiting the harmless OpenDNS test website, www.internetbadguys.com, and you should see the message, "This domain is blocked due to a phishing threat." There you go. That's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Did you like this tip or do you have a computer tip for me? Let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rogeski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. Public service announcements. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Eat Well, Think Clearly, and Live Fully, May 4th, 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120, that's 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, May the 5th, 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting May 9th, 7:15 p.m. on Tuesday, Rasa Room at the Palisades Mall on the fourth floor, West Nyack, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club is having its meeting Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is how to self-publish e-books, audiobooks, and paperback books. Meeting will be held at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, May 23rd, 7 p.m. in the community room at the Princeton Public Library, Princeton, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on iPad and smartphone, Together at Last, Thursday, May 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Meeting will be held at Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on smartphone ride services. Thursday, June 15th, 2 p.m., meeting at the Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or wbai.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up.
I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.